From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson.
No, they need help over at 1313 Sacramento, and they need help over at
It's Saturday, about 1 in the morning on Chicago's South Side. Two reporters are driving around monitoring a police scanner. Before long, they catch up with a shooting in progress.
1463, can we just go ahead and 19 Palo shots fired?
38th place.
On this block, about 15 minutes southwest of downtown, residents have gotten used to hearing gunshots.
So I'm looking at Chicago Scanner Twitter feed. Male, 22, shot.
As the paramedics respond, a skinny kid, about 12 years old, kicks a soccer ball next to his building.
I already told the cops that it was a black truck. We're like over there in the yard, and we just hear gunshots.
He makes it sound like it's no big deal, but President Trump has a different view. He's frequently lashed out, calling Chicago a total disaster. Anyone who knows the city understands there's so much more to it than the violence. Chicago Police Chief Eddie Johnson responded to the president's criticism this way on WBEZ Public Radio in December.
It ignores the hard work that the men and women of this department are doing to reduce this violence. And it also ignores the fact that the mayor has given us the resources that we need to reduce violence.
Those resources included more than 1,000 additional police officers. Johnson said more cops on the street helped bring down gun deaths.
We're now 100 homicides down from last year.
100 fewer homicides. Those numbers sound impressive. But are police counting the right thing? If murders are down, why is the violence still leading some people to flee the city while others hunker down to fight for their neighborhoods? Kevin Stark and Darnell Little are journalists with the Data Reporting Lab in Chicago. They spend a lot of time crunching numbers to better understand the issues facing Chicago. As they started digging into how the city tracks violence, they realized officials may be paying attention to the wrong thing. Kevin begins with the story of one man who's experienced gun violence for himself.
I meet up with 36-year-old Lamar Caples in the living room of his bungalow. He says he expected to spend a lot of his life on two wheels. That metallic blue Kawasaki Ninja. He'd ride it full throttle.
Oh, what a rush. It's fun. It's just like everything coming past you is a blur.
Especially on the highway, late at night. Out there, he felt a level of freedom he didn't always enjoy day to day. In the blocks around his childhood home, he constantly kept up his guard to avoid getting caught in somebody else's problem. The kind they'd settle with gunfire.
It was bad, but it wasn't this bad. Can't have a neighborhood store. People are going in there robbing them. Like, it's terrible.
It's a different story for people who live in or visit Chicago's lakefront, the downtown loop and much of the north side, home to major league sports, cultural attractions and entertainment, world-class shopping and dining. People on the city's largely black south and west sides, where Lamar lives, are dealing with decades of bad policy and broken promises rooted in deliberate racial segregation. The interstates cut through their neighborhoods and isolate them from the city that tourists see. Those same highways offer gang-neutral territory to Lamar.
Did I pass as a car? Yeah, the few that was out there, I passed them. State trooper, passed them too. They couldn't catch me.
Eventually, though, bullets did. Twice. The first time, he got hit in the stomach while he was riding in a car. The second, a couple years later, happened outside of a neighborhood restaurant.
Someone came through shooting. I got hit in the back. I was trying to run and, you know, get out the way. And unfortunately, I was one of the ones that got shot. I felt like a feather.
He might have felt weightless, but a scar he rubs on his forehead makes it clear that he hit concrete. A bullet to his back put him in a wheelchair. Lamar says he thinks he recognized at least one of the people who shot him from another neighborhood. But he has no idea why it happened. He was a steelworker, a bulked up guy who lifted weights after his shift at the mill. He had some brushes with the law, but he says he didn't have to run with a gang.
I wasn't raised that way.
To feel like a target. Chicago is not the large city where you're most likely to get shot and killed. That distinction belongs to St. Louis, with 60 shooting deaths for every 100,000 people. Chicago still leads the pack with about 650 homicides in 2017, more than Los Angeles and New York City combined.
But those numbers don't tell the whole story.
That's my reporting partner, Darnell Little.
The FBI tracks violent crimes and homicides, but it doesn't record how many shootings happen. Local law enforcement does the same thing, so there's no reliable count from police of how many people get shot and survive. But someone does have that information, the Illinois Department of Public Health. We filed a request with that agency, and Kevin and I got a few Excel spreadsheets from them.
I'm looking at two spreadsheets here. We have shootings and homicides. How does this line up with, anecdotally, what you've heard from people in communities on Chicago's south and west sides?
So if we look at this spreadsheet for homicides from 1990 to 2015 and make a quick line chart, we can easily see that homicides have significantly dropped over that time period.
And this is essentially the story that we hear from police, that homicides are really high in the 90s and that it's been decreasing over time.
Yes, but let's take a look at shootings. If we go over here to the spreadsheet, the trend line is pretty straight. It's actually even going up slightly.
This is a very different story. This is not the story of a city that has declining gun violence. Shootings are either steady or they're going up.
Right. And so you look at just the homicides and you see one story. You look at the number of people being shot and you see a different story.
The proof was in the billing. The state public health department sent us hospital invoices. They showed at the same time shootings increased in Chicago by 15%, gun homicides dropped by 30%. Even though people are likelier than ever to get shot multiple times with what shooters call RIP bullets, designed to explode inside bodies on impact.
So if more people are getting shot with deadlier ammunition, why is the murder rate dropping?
Darnell stopped by the place that overhauled emergency medicine and changed the game for gunshot victims.
Stroger Hospital is really the nerve center of the trauma system here in Chicago. When you make that 911 call, you're far more likely to encounter an operator in that 911 center who has medical training. We've got 100 firehouses covering the city of Chicago. Every one of those firehouses has paramedics. Our fleet of ambulances are all equipped for advanced life support.
One of those ambulances took Lamar Caples to Stroger after his second shooting. All he remembered was the way he felt.
Bumpy. Hurting every time they hit a bump because I was already in pain.
Chicago's chief paramedic, Mary Sheridan, says her crews try to ease that pain way before they deliver a patient to the emergency room.
We can breathe for that patient, and we can circulate his blood with chest compressions, and we can keep him warm and get him to the trauma center where he can go into their operating room right away.
The entire trip, paramedics and the emergency room team at the hospital are communicating with each other and monitoring a patient's vital signs. By doing this, Mary says,
we're buying him 10 or 15 minutes. But with penetrating trauma to the chest or any significant trauma, you are losing blood, you only have 4 to 6 minutes.
4 to 6 minutes. After that, in most cases, it's too late to save your life.
Chicago's trauma centers learn how to act fast from combat medical teams. They visit Stroger Hospital to share best practices and battlefield-tested techniques.
Yes, they do shifts alongside us.
Dr. Farhan Bakari is in charge of trauma and burn surgery at Stroger. He says his team and the military doctors learn from one another. The civilians handle more casualties in their ER than the combat veterans generally do in the field.
Because the amount of severe injury that we see, they don't see that cumulatively. They'll see it during 6 months. A lot of my physicians have been doing this for like a decade. The exposure is much more continuous and extensive here.
Continuous and extensive, because street fights can escalate quickly into shootouts. The Stroger Emergency Room treats, on average, 1,100 gunshot patients a year. It costs a lot to keep them alive. The most recent statistics from the University of Chicago Crime Lab show the city spent $2.5 billion a year on gunshot victims for medical care, lost wages, and reduced productivity. That's an average of $2,500 per household. Without its trauma care system, one criminologist we spoke with says Chicago would still log close to 1,000 gun-related murders a year, higher than the peak of 970 homicides in 1974.
Chicago police wouldn't talk to us about what we found, but we did speak with Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle. Cook is the county that includes Chicago. It controls Stroger Hospital. I told Tony what our research had found.
If we're getting a lot better at treating gunshot trauma and people are surviving, that's your point, then it's not really the murder rate, but the shootings that we ought to be looking at, the number of shootings. I see your point. In a way, the world-class nature of our trauma care masks, to some extent, the problem.
Do you see a solution there?
We can't just look at the murders and the shootings. We have to look at the communities out of which these folks come and see what we can do to address the challenges that the communities face. Otherwise, they will just continue to produce at-risk young people. And, I think you're well aware that the people who are at risk for being shot are the same people who are at risk for being shooters.
That could have been Lamar.
When I got shot, I was like, I'm ready to kill now. But I know better than that now. I calm down, realize, I got a lot to live for, and that's not for me. It's not for me at all. So I'm not gonna let my situation turn me into a bad person.
Lamar gets by. Disability benefits and money his former coworkers at the steel mill raised for him help. Health insurance covered some of the medical costs, but he's still got a lifetime of bills to pay. His family and fiance pitch in too. When he thinks about his future, he says he'd like to work with other gunshot survivors.
People that feel like there's no hope for them, even if they're in the chair for the rest of their life, I would still like to be there to laugh with them, still to encourage them in the things that they may think is too hard for them to do. Let them know my situation. Let them know how much God bless me. That's all.
Lamar says sometimes he feels his legs again. He prays a lot, lifts weights at home, and 3 times a week, he goes to the gym.
Kevin Stark and Darnell Little of the Data Reporting Lab in Chicago brought us that story. Here's the big questions that got them started. Would it matter at all if officials focused on how many people get shot instead of how many die? Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County Commission president, told us that could change the way local government budgets its money.
We need to be sure that those young people who have been shot the first time don't find themselves at risk or put themselves at risk to be shot again. And that's a holistic approach to their recovery, not just physically from the wound, but from all of the factors that led them to be a gunshot victim in the first place.
Like 25 Chicagoans during this year's Martin Luther King holiday weekend. When we come back, we'll meet another Southsider who, despite this and other problems, is determined to stay.
Because we have to fight for what's right. We have to take back Chicago.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Byer Duncan here, an engagement reporter at Reveal. If you want to dig deeper into Kevin and Darnell's analysis, head over to citylab.com/Chicago. You'll find an immersive print story that complements the piece you just heard. It goes into even more detail about how improvements in trauma care may be partially masking the true scale of Chicago gun violence. If you don't know about CityLab, it's this awesome site dedicated to the people who are creating the cities of the future. They focus on design, transportation, equity, and life in urban environments. Again, to find our story, go to citylab.com/Chicago. Thanks.
Have you tried to hire someone lately? It's hard, but it doesn't have to be, thanks to LinkedIn. You already know LinkedIn is the world's largest professional network. Well, it's also a better way to find great talent. Just ask any of the hundreds of thousands of businesses who have posted to LinkedIn Jobs over the past year. And because LinkedIn considers skills, experiences, location, and more to match and promote your job to potential candidates, businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs 40% higher than job boards at delivering quality candidates. 70% of the U.S. workforce is already on LinkedIn, and 22 million professionals view and apply to jobs on LinkedIn every week. Go to linkedin.com/reveal today and get a $50 credit toward your first job post. That's linkedin.com/reveal for your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. If you've ever visited Chicago, you probably know that it's famous for its public art. In Millennium Park along Lake Michigan, tourists jockey for selfies in front of a massive stainless steel sculpture called Cloudgate. Then there's the Picasso, created by the master himself. This modern-day sculpture stands 50 feet high and resembles the artist's cubist paintings. In Federal Plaza, just a few blocks away, you'll come face-to-face with Alexander Calder's flamingo. At 53 feet tall, this bright orange-red abstract sculpture is a mass of steel, elegantly bending over on itself, like it's about to do a back handspring. Right nearby is a 100-year-old building that was home to the Chicago Public Schools. They've since sold the building, but in May of 2013, hundreds of parents, teachers, and students made their way there to protest a plan that would shut down 50 schools. It was right before the Memorial Day weekend. The sky was filled with dark clouds with occasional rain falling. In the hearing room, people fidgeted in their seats, waiting to speak. They'd approach the microphone wearing T-shirts with slogans like, "Every school is my school," "Stand with Chicago's Teachers Union," and "Save our schools." Each speaker got just 2 minutes, and they let the school board have it.
I've been waiting 3 months for these 2 minutes. You're attacking our children and breaking our communities. And we need these schools. If there's one thing you've done right that I can actually say is that you have made our community come together and fight this battle.
I have a dream. I have a dream. I'm going to go home and I'm going to tell my daughter that there's one hero on the board, one person that's going to stand up and go against this and say, I'm going to keep Courtney Elementary alive as a choice and an option for all Chicago students.
Thank you, Ms. Tuthorn. Our next speaker.
There were so many hearings. At one of them, a woman named Irene Robinson found the courage to speak up in favor of her neighborhood school, Overton Elementary.
I'm kind of nervous, but I just want to say we want to support Overton and do whatever we can to keep it open. I have 6 grandbabies go to Overton, but all of the babies are my babies.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson.
Irene got more comfortable with public speaking over the years, sparring with the city and the school board over the school closing plan. At the time, Chicago's school CEO was Barbara Bird Bennett, and right before the school board voted on the plan, she defended it.
I know that change is not easy to embrace, but I do not believe that we can deviate from what is right. We cannot maintain a system that cannot be sustained and one which does not benefit children.
The school board voted to close 50 schools, the largest public school shutdown in the country. The city promised not to close any more schools for 5 years. Now, time's up, and more schools could close. What will that mean for students and their families? The Chicago Reporter's Kaylin Belsha has been investigating that question by looking at how the last round of shutdowns has affected people in Chicago.
With 6 kids and 18 grandkids, plus foster kids, Irene Robinson is the kind of person who takes care of everyone around her. Whenever I see her, she's wearing purple. Lipstick, glasses, T-shirts. She tells me purple makes life bearable.
All my life, I took care of children, and my house was an open door to all the Anthony Overton children.
Overton was a school on Chicago's South Side, across the street from where Irene used to live. And the kids she sent there brought back a bunch of good news. Irene keeps the evidence in envelopes filled with photos and awards.
This is my baby girl report card from Anthony Overton.
Wow, yeah. 2005.
Yeah.
Because the school was such a big part of her life, Irene remembers clearly when the district started cutting teachers and programs.
It don't take a rocket scientist. Anyone could see that formula is to destroy it.
School officials called that formula student-based budgeting. It's exactly what it sounds like. If a school enrolls more kids, it gets more money. The district decided to shut down schools with fewer kids to create a bunch of bigger ones with bigger budgets. Officials promised to invest in those schools. They called them welcoming schools, with extras like air conditioning and iPads. Nearly all the schools the district closed were in historically Black neighborhoods, like Bronzeville.
Our people, our grandparents, when they left down south, they came to Bronzeville, and they built here. My heart is here.
Irene tells me this as we ride along her old neighborhood's main drag, Martin Luther King Drive. There's a monument to the millions of African Americans whose migration changed Chicago and the nation. A giant bronze statue of a man holding a worn suitcase, waving with his right hand. The public housing complexes that used to tower over this area are all gone. So are the people who used to live in them. Irene says some of the families who stayed the longest moved away when the school district closed Overton. That school had anchored the families and teachers who lived nearby.
We need our neighborhood schools. This is important. Neighborhood schools are the heart of our community.
Developers put up expensive new condos. Rents all over went up. Irene and others couldn't afford to stay. Now, when she visits her old apartment, she says she feels like a stranger on her block. She places a lot of blame for all this change on Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He controls public schools like few big city mayors do. He appoints the school's chief and the school board. He declined her many requests for an interview. In general, he doesn't like to talk about this. But at a press conference in 2013, after the school shutdown list came out, reporters grilled him. He acknowledged the plan would upset students and their parents.
This is very difficult. A lot of anguish, and I understand that, and I appreciate it. But the anguish and the pain that comes from making the change pales compared to the anguish that comes by trapping children in schools that are not succeeding. Thank you very much.
The mayor said it would take time, but kids would eventually end up in better schools.
And the whole effort is about making sure that every child, regardless of where they live, regardless of their circumstances, has the opportunity to go to a quality school and receive a high-quality education.
Irene, along with many parents and students, didn't buy the mayor's promise. They let him know that, loud and clear. Their protests got a lot of coverage from local outlets like WBBM News Radio.
On the west side, Mike Krauser, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. These people are portraying Mayor Emanuel as a lying racist.
Does that new Chicago mean no more Black folks?
Right.
Where are people going to go? They're not going to stay around in the community if there are no schools.
In the end, Overton and 49 other schools closed. About 11,000 students, most of them Black and poor, had to transfer. They were supposed to go to higher performing schools. But researchers at the University of Chicago found later that most kids didn't end up at schools that were much better than the ones they'd left. Irene's 13-year-old grandson, Eric, knows what that feels like. I caught up with him at a family party.
And this is Eric, my grandson.
He used to go to a school he loved, Wadsworth Elementary on the south side.
I've been at Wadsworth for a long, long time. And then when it closed, I thought I'd go to a school I could meet new people that close too. Like we had music there. I liked the new music. I really like music. But we don't have it now.
When Eric's parents heard Wadsworth was going to close, they planned to send him to Overton, where he'd been a student before his family moved. But both of those schools closed in 2013, and Eric had to transfer to a different school. He lost touch with his friends from Wadsworth and had to start over.
You would think after they closed the first time, that would probably be it. But when it happens again and again and again, now you start getting a little frustrated. How many times you got to transfer because of and stuff you don't even know. Like, I don't even know when the school closed.
In recent years, Chicago has invested a lot of money to keep middle and upper class kids in the public schools with new or expanded buildings. But when most of the kids are low income, Black, and Latino, the district closes their schools, fires the entire faculty and hires a new one, or sometimes it uses one building to house two separate schools. Let me explain the thinking here. If enrollment is low in one school, why not put another school inside it and use the empty classrooms? That hasn't worked out so well. First, kids still have to share spaces like gyms and auditoriums. Second, the new schools often compete with the old ones for students. Remember, bigger enrollment means more money. This whole idea that schools need to have more kids in them doesn't make sense to University of Chicago sociologist Eve Ewing.
Some of our most elite academic institutions tout low enrollment as being a great thing.
Eve holds an education doctorate from Harvard. She taught in one of the schools that closed in 2013. She's writing a book about what happened.
It's fascinating because the idea that a school building should be efficient in how many kids it holds is really not an educationally sound or pedagogically sound way of making decisions. But when it comes to poor Black students, the idea is basically that we need to efficiently fit as many kids into a building as possible.
Some of Irene's grandkids felt that after Overton Elementary closed. Their mom, June, says their welcoming school was too crowded and really hard to get to. June and her kids used to share an apartment with Irene. In the last year or so, they've shifted from seeing each other all the time to visiting like this.
Hello.
Hey, baby.
Hey,
June is 29. She's the third of Irene's four daughters. Her job at a McDonald's in Chicago barely covered her expenses. Hoping for a place of her own, she spent years on a waitlist for public housing, but never got in.
Have you did your Christmas shopping yet?
Yeah, I did a little bit of it.
Well, you know I'm trying to find a day to come down there. Even though I was with you for Thanksgiving, that wasn't enough because your mama missed you. I mean, you don't know how much I miss you.
Too.
I just hate that y'all so spread it apart.
To improve life for her family, June decided to move out of the neighborhood, more than 200 miles away, to Cedar Rapids.
Had you ever been to Iowa before you moved out there?
No, never. You know, I was already at the bottom, and it's like, I just had to take a chance, and I'm kind of happy I did.
A lot of Black families have taken chances, like June. Chicago's African-American population has dropped by 250,000 since 2000. During that time, the city's public schools lost 90,000 Black students. In Iowa, June is thriving. She quickly found work at a Nordstrom warehouse where she makes $15 an hour, a big boost from her fast food job. And her rent is a couple hundred dollars less than what she paid for her tiny Chicago apartment. Now, she's in a two-bedroom rental with lots of room for her kids to play.
Oh, yeah. It's a townhouse, and my rent is $550. It's nice. It looks like a little mini house.
A bus picks up her kids right in front of the house. Inside, there's a couch and other items that parents and staff from the school gave to their family. June's kids are adjusting well in a new school district that mostly enrolls kids from white, well-off families. That isn't the case for many kids who leave Chicago's poor, segregated Black schools. I analyzed records for 15,000 students who left Chicago for the suburbs or other Illinois towns in recent years. I found that a third of them landed in poorly funded, racially segregated schools, pretty much like the ones they'd left. Except that many staff in their new school districts felt overwhelmed by the health and emotional issues these kids carried with them. Even though June says she and her kids are doing real good, they still feel the distance from the rest of their family.
I just actually miss, laying next to my mama, being under my mama. I can't see her and touch her and stuff like that.
Irene misses her daughter just as much. But these days, she's putting a lot of her energy in one direction.
Once I lost Anthony Overton School, I vowed that I would fight for all children, all schools, because I really didn't understand what they was doing when they were closing school.
That helps explain her work to reopen a high school named after Walter Diet, a legendary music teacher and band leader in Chicago. It's on the city's south side, not far from Irene's apartment. Before and after the district closed it, she and others organized as usual.
We went to board meeting. We went and we protested. We talked to the mayor. I have spoken with Ron Emanuel several times, tell him how this would hurt our children. We did everything.
Eventually, their protest ended up on the news, too.
Diet High School hunger strikers are now into their 31st day without solid food, and the strain on their health is beginning to show. The hunger strikers say this whole issue is about race, unequal distribution of city resources, and a lack of respect from CPS and City Hall.
Police arrested Irene during her protest to save the school. Twice. Once, just before the hunger strike began, she blocked elevators at City Hall. A year earlier, she chained herself to the bronze statue of George Washington outside the mayor's office. Speaking to crowds didn't faze her anymore. Not after refusing solid food put her in the hospital for a little while.
Because we have to fight for what's right. We have to take back Chicago. And when Ron Emanuel closed school, he hurt our children. Closing school is a hate crime.
Irene and the hunger strikers did reopen that school. They called it a small victory in a big, long fight. Although her daughter June moved away, Irene has managed to keep other people she loves in the city, like her second daughter Shayna and her husband Tyrell. Their son is Eric.
He's my little shadow, so he's always behind me wherever I go. You know, I feel lucky that at his age, I'm still his primary influence.
I talked with Tyrell in the kitchen of the bungalow they bought on the far south side. He's 31, with a college degree and a corporate job in Chicago's west suburbs. His commute puts him on the road nearly 2.5 hours every weekday. Tyrell had wanted to move his family closer to work, but his mother-in-law wasn't having it.
We had this discussion 1,000 times before where, you know, she wanted to fight. When it was time for me to buy my house, I wasn't looking here. I was looking to leave. And I feel like a lot of black men do that because that just seems like what we're supposed to do. But then Irene just showed me a different way. Like, we need to stay here and show that you can be successful here.
You're a fine man.
You can't abandon everybody. You can't just provide for your family and elevate your family and forget about everybody else and your heritage and where you come from.
Our ancestor came to the south side. They built here. But now our children don't even know half of the history that our grandparents have left. And that's sad.
The fight to save the schools and her neighborhood wears Irene down. Sometimes she feels older than 53. Her job as a home health care aide required a lot of bending and lifting. Now, Irene battles arthritis in her knees. That pain and feelings of depression can keep her in bed some days. Shayna says that's the price Irene pays for what the grandkids admiringly call her fightful side.
Do you ever worry that your mom's going to get really tired? I mean, I know she puts a lot of work into it, and so I wonder, like, how do you...
No, I don't think she's getting tired. This motivates her. This gives her strength. This make her, you know, want to fight even more. If anything, I worry that she's going to explode.
Oh, grandma, I need help, y'all.
My kids have begged me to take a break.
In her own apartment, away from Shannon and Tyrell's kitchen, Irene says she knows why.
They is afraid that when I go to jail or being on a hunger strike, but I had to really talk to them and make them understand that this is something I have to do. What do you do? When you are very clear on what's going on, what do? You can't close your eyes and walk away.
If she and other activists had done that, the city might have gone forward with a plan to close 4 majority black high schools on the south side to make way for a new consolidated one. That plan would have made the students who are in those schools now transfer to other struggling high schools across town and across gang boundaries. When I spoke with her last fall, the current school's chief, Janice Jackson, told me district officials want to treat this situation differently than the closings in 2013.
Dear CPS community, as your CEO, I have promised that your school district will listen.
Earlier this month on Twitter, she shared an announcement that suggested they meant it, even though some people saw it as a way for the mayor to win political support from African Americans.
The more we talked to you, the more we heard how important it was for some students to stay and graduate from their current school. In response to your feedback, we are modifying our proposal.
Instead of shutting down the four high schools all at once, the district will give students in three of the schools the option to finish where they are or transfer to another school.
I want you to know that we have heard your concerns, and we are happy to modify this proposal to ensure it supports all students.
Still, none of them will be able to attend the new high school when it opens next year because it will start by enrolling only ninth graders. This plan doesn't do a thing for Irene. She figures the four high schools are still going to close and hurt the surrounding neighborhoods. The only difference, she believes, is that the school district's letting it happen gradually, like a slow death. If officials were really listening, she says, they would invest in and maintain the existing schools. So Irene will protest what she calls a bad policy, just as if her own family's school was on the line.
That was Kaylin Belsha of the Chicago Reporter. By the way, we should mention that the former CEO, Barbara Bird Bennett, who we heard from at the top of this story, is now in prison. Last year, a judge sentenced Bird Bennett to 4.5 years for planning to collect hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes by steering contracts to her former employer, an education consulting company. When we come back, we'll meet the South Side's Lois Lane. Reporter Natalie Moore will talk to us about her Chicago and the city's most chronic problem.
Until Chicago addresses segregation, we're going to continue to be a city of inequities.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. You gotta be tough to stay and fight when your neighbors, even your loved ones, want to move away. Journalist Natalie Moore knows about that. She's the author of 3 nonfiction books and a reporter for public radio station WBEZ in Chicago. Natalie's a third-generation Chicagoan. All 4 of her grandparents were part of the African-American migration from the South and escaped from terror and stifled opportunities.
On my father's side, my grandfather was from Nashville. He had 2 brothers who had to get out of town. One was accused of raping a white woman, and another one got into a fight with some white men. And they had to be whisked away because they could have been lynched. He just said, I'm done, and came here. And my grandparents were able to buy a home, buy rental properties. They were able to send their children to college, first generation.
In her book, Southside, Natalie writes about how segregation shaped the way she looks at the world. When she was 14, she hopped on a train downtown for a concert on the South Side. She noticed something she'd never seen. All the white people were usually off the train by then. It shook her up that they stayed on. Finally, when the train reached the White Sox Stadium, they flooded out and she could relax again. Natalie never forgot that train ride or the fight or flight instinct it triggered. She lived at the time in Chatham, a South Side neighborhood she calls
this kind of cozy racial cocoon. My parents instilled a lot of cultural pride in me and my siblings, and we supported Black-owned businesses in the neighborhood, and there were Black clubs, there was civic life. I did know that there weren't some of the same amenities in my neighborhood as there were in other parts of the city, but it was a great place to grow up. I had friends there. I was in Girl Scouts there. I went to church there. It was a great neighborhood.
So I've been reading The South Side, which I love. For our listeners who haven't read the book, can you tell me about how Chatham became a hub of the Black middle class?
Chatham is a Black South Side middle class neighborhood that I grew up in. And Chatham was one of the neighborhoods that experienced white flight. So in 1940, you know, it was all white. And then when restrictive covenants were struck down by the Supreme Court in 1948, you saw black people start to move in. And so from 1950 to 1960, you go from 99% white to 99% black. And Chatham became one of many, many neighborhoods on the South and West sides that opened up to African Americans.
Can I tell you that your love for Chatham just jumps out of the book? Like, I can, every time you talk about it, I feel like you're giving me a warm hug.
Oh, that makes me smile. Good. That was what I was intending to do.
Can you connect the dots to how things like segregation have led to these issues that we're seeing now? Or are they connected at all?
What makes Chicago unique is that it's diverse, yet segregated. In Chicago, the city is about a third black, a third white, and a third Latino. But we typically don't live, work, or play together. This wasn't by accident, and people need to understand that these policies have been set and these patterns have been set for decades. Mm-hmm. My argument is that until Chicago addresses segregation, we're going to continue to be a city of inequities. Let's take schools, for example. There was never any real effort to integrate Chicago public schools. This could have happened in the 1960s when you still had a significant white population. You had white families who resisted. But more importantly to note is that the mayor, Richard J. Daley, resisted. You start to see the white student population in the public school system decline. Some people will say, well, how can schools be integrated if housing is segregated? That's an excuse. The biggest problem is that we don't acknowledge or address segregation.
Policies that were put in place by the city of Chicago to limit African Americans, to segregate them, exactly like what happened there that plays out today?
This was bigger than segregation. It was also about trying to stymie black wealth. Like, we don't even want you in your own communities to be able to own homes. It goes beyond the city of Chicago. You had racially restrictive covenants, which were deeds to homes that said you cannot sell or rent your property to someone black. And then you had redlining that came about in the 1930s. That literally drew a line around black neighborhoods and said, these are high-risk places, don't give loans there. Redlining went away, but those forces shaped our neighborhoods, and it shaped what happened.
A lot of times you hear from the national media stories about Chicago. In this hour, we've talked about violence in Chicago. We've talked about school closings. Now it seems that African Americans are leaving Chicago sort of en masse. Why is that? Like, who are the people that are leaving?
I think when we talk about population loss, it comes across as if people just in the past few weeks have been packing up their bags and leaving. We've seen this trend for decades. There's been some research around who is leaving. You have low-income people who are leaving. I think you also have middle-class people who are leaving because the suburban dream is something that African-Americans buy into also. They maybe want the school system out there. They want a bigger house. They want a different style of living. I think it's difficult to paint, like, who is this one person, but affordability is an issue for people. Jobs is an issue for people. And I think it's a complicated mix of why people leave. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we look at black neighborhoods through the lens of deficits and not through assets.
In the book, you talk about how home ownership has, you know, been the way that we've been told that you create wealth in this country. But for black people, that's not the case. Can you explain why that is?
There's research that shows that if your neighborhood is 10% black or more, that's when values start to go down. Now, I want to be clear, this is not about these black families moved in and the neighborhoods declined. No, this is about how things are valued. And there's an undervaluation in black neighborhoods.
You were 20 years old and away at college, and your parents moved away from Chatham.
Yes.
Why did they move?
they wanted more house and they wanted more value for their house. They moved to an integrated neighborhood on the South Side, integrated meaning Black and white, but mostly white. And the way the system is set up is that if you are Black and you buy in a Black neighborhood, the cards are stacked against you. You know, one thing that I will say is that the Blackness that people have in their imagination in this country, I think, tends to be the poor Black person and then the exceptional Black person. So your Obamas, your Oprahs.
Natalie Moore's.
No, not me. I'm not rich. your celebrity of that stature. And then there's the image of the poor, the ghetto, the despondent. And I think there's a real invisibility of middle class and working class Black people in this country.
I can hear the love of Chicago. Why do you love Chicago?
There's an expression here, Chicago over everything. Despite all of its problems, this is a city with grit. It's a city with innovation. There's a lot that's inspiring. The cultural workers who are here, the Black Club people who are trying to make their neighborhood a little bit better. That's part of our fabric. In some ways, it's a little tribal, and I say that in a positive way. The ties that people have go long and deep, and there's beauty in every corner of the city.
There is nothing like Summertime Shy.
Nothing like it.
I lived in Chicago for 6 months. I was standing on the Bryn Mawr L, and I watched the wind come off of the lake and reach up and grab me and say, Florida boy, go home. I was like, yes, sir. Bye.
Well, that's the grit, you know, like that built character. That's the Chicago character.
Natalie Moore, author of Southside and reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
We started this hour with a reference to President Trump calling Chicago a total disaster. And as you've heard throughout the hour, the city has issues, just like every city in America, in the world. But for some, Chicago has become a talking point, a place to point out the failures of democratic governance. The city is used in the gun debate because it has stricter gun laws than many parts of the country. Or if a racial incident happens anywhere in America, commentators, politicians, and Twitter bots will point to the city and ask, what about Chicago? Black on Black crime? What about those Black kids? No one cares. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Yes, guns are in Chicago despite laws because they flow in from areas outside the city that don't have strict gun laws. And no, Black on Black crime is not an actual thing unless we begin to categorize white on white crime. Statistics tell us that crime happens among people who live closest to one another, and Chicago is an extremely segregated city. But how do we get here? A while back, Bomani Jones, a sports commentator, gave one of the clearest breakdowns of the problem that I've heard.
In Chicago, when Black people moved to that city from the South in the 1940s and 1950s, white people got the hell out of Dodge. They built a freeway system that ran through Black neighborhoods, and the whole purpose of that freeway system was to get white people from the suburbs into their jobs safely without having to make any stops in between. That's what housing discrimination does. Housing discrimination is the biggest reason that we could point to historically for why we got all these dead kids in Chicago fighting for turf, fighting for real estate with poor accommodations and facilities and everything that you're supposed to have within the city, poor education, all of this because the tax dollars and everything else decided to move away. And when you can't do that, you wind up in basically what are like these neighborhoods that are created by apartheid.
And he's right. And yet, in spite of all the problems, Chicago still stands. If you've never been there, it may be hard to hold on to these two ideas, a faltering city versus the city that works. Maybe it's more appropriate to say the city that puts in work. You see, every day, Chicagoans are rolling up their sleeves in every neighborhood on every block. You'll find people like the ones we met in today's show, Irene Robinson, the grandma who's taking on City Hall to keep schools open, Mary Sheridan, the city's chief paramedic, who's giving victims of crime a fighting chance. And Eve Ewing, the noted sociologist and former teacher, who's demanding better futures for the city's young people, like all of us should, whether we live in Chicago or not. We mentioned housing discrimination throughout the show. Many people think that's an issue we solved 50 years ago with the Fair Housing Act, but we found that lenders are still turning down people of color at greater rates than white people in cities around the country. We reported on that last week. If you missed it, you can still listen to that show on our podcast. Just go to iTunes, Radio Public, or anywhere you listen to podcasts and subscribe to Reveal. Today's show was produced by Bill Healy and Anayasi Diaz-Cortez. Cheryl Duvall edited our show. Thanks to the Data Reporting Lab, to the Chicago Reporter, and to public TV station WTTW, public radio station WBEZ, WBBM News Radio, and to the Chicago Sun-Times for archival sound. Our production manager is Mwende Hinojosa. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. Amy Powell's our editor-in-chief, and Krista Scharfenberg is our acting CEO. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson. And remember, there is always more to the story.